Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and yesterday before he spoke at CPAC in Dallas, that's former President Trump, of course. He spoke with Maria Bartiromo on Fox News, Fox Business. And a significant part of the discussion was about January 6th. It's interesting. The things that you're told not to talk about, the things that you're told you just have to accept the left's perspective on it. If you tell that to President Trump, that's exactly what he wants to talk about and is going to talk about. And that's exactly what he did on Bartiromo. Listen to his dissertation on what happened on January 6th, because he recognizes that with this kangaroo court committee that Pelosi and the House Democrat Socialists have set up, that it's going to be unavoidable. So you can't run and hide. You have to stand and deliver.
And the reason, in my opinion, you had over a million people there, which the press doesn't like to report at all, because it shows too much activity, too much spirit and faith and love. There was such love at that rally. You had over a million people there. They were there for one reason, the rigged election. They felt the election was rigged. That's why they were there. And they were peaceful people. These were great people. The crowd was unbelievable. And I mentioned the word love, the love in the air. I've never seen anything like it. And, you know, that's why they went to Washington. And by the way, I can tell you that I thought, because I was hearing from a lot of people, going to be a lot of people coming there, much bigger than anybody ever anticipated by many times. And I had suggested to the Secretary of Defense, perhaps we should have 10,000 National Guardsmen standing by. And he reported that, as you know, and he was turned down. I said, it's subject to Congress. You know, they run it. Nancy Pelosi runs it. So it would be subject to the Capitol Police and the other things, whatever they need. But I said, perhaps you need 10,000, because I think the crowd is going to be very large. Who knows? Maybe two people will show up, but I think it's going to be very large. Anyway, he had that. He went to them. They said it won't be necessary.
And there's still a lot of unanswered questions about January 6th that Democrat socialists don't seem very concerned about answering. The performance of Capitol Police, per that report that was referenced by the FBI, look at this. The knowledge that Mitch McConnell had, that the respective House and Senate sergeants at arms had before January 6th, what they communicated to Pelosi in the House, to Mitch McConnell. Yeah. In the Senate.
And they were both removed from their positions after it.
A lot of unanswered questions. And of course, one of the unanswered questions is the confirmation as to who we understand was the Capitol Hill police officer, Capitol Police officer, that shot and killed Ashley Babbitt. We reported on this on Friday per Paul Sperry's excellent investigative report in realclearinvestigations.com. He identified the officer. He identified the officer as one Michael Byrd, the Capitol Police lieutenant, because he was identified by one of the sergeants at arms in testimony that was scrubbed from C-SPAN on the Hill, testimony on the Hill, scrubbed from C-SPAN. And he also matches up with the profile of the officer from the knowledge we have of video and so on and so forth. But, it's the name that shall not be spoken. And this raises other questions about just exactly how the Capitol Police operate different than every other law enforcement agency in the country, including the Secret Service, their exemption from FOIA, the exemption from having to disclose police misconduct records to the public, it's problematic stuff, and there are questions that should be raised whether you like Trump or don't.
Well, they should change their policy. That's ridiculous.
In addition to that, Trump raises the comparison that many have raised and should continue to, the treatment by law enforcement of those rioters at the Hill on 1-6 versus the rioters on America's streets last summer.
Right. There were no guns whatsoever. And yet Antifa, which went into Portland and went into so many other places, Seattle, they took over a big part of Seattle. People died. And there were plenty of guns there, by the way. And in Minnesota and Minneapolis, they got, there was no repercussions for them. And yet they have people still in jail. There were no guns. There were no guns. And by the way, while you're at it, who shot Ashley Babbitt? Why are they keeping that secret? Who was the person that shot an innocent, wonderful, incredible woman, a military woman, right in the head? And there's no repercussions. If that were on the other side, it would be the biggest story in this country. Who shot Ashley Babbitt? People want to know, and why.
Well, here's the thing about, you know, the Ashley Babbitt character. She's a wonderful woman.
She did serve our country. She
served in the military.
Should she have been there? No.
People serve in the military. They go on to do bad things.
Right.
It happens. So the characterization of it does need to be over the top. The question is, what happened on that day? She was that a justified shooting? The conclusion was that it was. I think there's an argument to be made that it was because she did have a backpack, and you don't know what's in that backpack. There's the feeling that the Capitol police officers were going to be overrun by the number of people inside the Capitol at that time. Now, the flip side is the video we see of Capitol police officers, you know, escorting
the QAnon
shaman to the well of the House floor and sort of seeing to be accommodating and seeing not to be particularly frightened about most of the protesters. Something else that Trump raised, and by the way, there are people who are facing gun charges. It's a handful.
But right,
when you say there's
are
no guns, it's, you know, this kind of his tendency to speak in absolutes, which you should resist the temptation to do. But there were some people charged with gun crimes. But the other point that he makes about people that are still being detained, you know, if you go to the Department of Justice website, capital breach cases, but it's interesting they call it capital breach. They don't call it an insurrection. Capital breach cases, they give you a list of all the case numbers and the names and the charges. And there is something to this. When you're charged with criminal trespass, when you're charged with disruptive conduct in a restricted building, which a lot of these charges are, you're being held without bail.
It's like you're a political prisoner. There are different rules for different people.
You know, I know, you know,
I know a lot of people don't like the QAnon shaman, but he was not weaponized. That was part of his costume. And he cannot get out. He can't post bond. They've denied him bail.
Right. It's worth remembering that our laws are to protect the people we don't like. But why we have due process in this country, because we don't like people charged with crimes. We don't like people who inflict harm on other people. We don't like that behavior, but we have to protect their rights. Just as we talk about free speech, tolerating somebody is not liking them or agreeing with them. Tolerating somebody is saying, I don't agree with them or like them, but I understand that they have a right to say or do or have access to the same things that I do. And that seems to be lost in this conversation too. You can find what happened on January 6th reprehensible, as I do, and say, well, due process still attaches to those people arrested and charged with crimes. You can say that we still want to understand exactly what the nature of it was versus the demagoguery that we're being treated to in an unrelenting fashion on cable news networks every single day in the last 6 months since. Those distinctions seem to be lost. I know it's the intention of the D.C. press corps to blur those distinctions, and it's important that we don't allow those distinctions to be blurred. I mean, if you believe in the rule of law. And President Trump apparently does, interestingly. since he's the one charged with inciting the riot. The other point, of course, is his reference to talking with his attorney general, talking with FBI about the need for a law enforcement presence on January 6th because of the anticipation there would be big crowds.
And never forget who said no to that. Nancy Pelosi and Capitol Police said they didn't need it. And they knew something was coming.
Bob in Buffalo Grove, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Thanks for taking my call, Dan and Amy. I caught just a portion of the Maria Bartiromo program, and then also during the Trump speech at CPAC. Another big issue that he brought up was Hunter's laptop, and I'd like to point out the censorship of the media. The way the whole media, not just say the whole, but the left-wing media covered up a lot of stuff. They controlled the narrative. And it's going to be interesting with this lawsuit with Trump against Facebook and Twitter, what stuff might come out with regards to how the media spun possibly the election.
Thanks for the call, Bob.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, you were talking about Trump's forays yesterday, one with Maria Bartiromo, and you've seen the headlines, I'm sure, the hand-wringing and the pearl-clutching over saying there were good people there on January 6th, obviously trying to gaslight people into believing he's characterizing the rioters like the peaceful people, just as they did with Charlottesville.
And that there was a lot of love there, because he said that.
So all of that, and also, by the way, Trump was asked by Bartiromo before we moved to his comments on CPAC if, you know, the operative question. So what's your status as it pertains to 2024? Here's how that went.
All right. So the question is, will you make the run again? You said that you know your answer, but you're not revealing it yet. You ready to get back in that ring and run for president again, sir?
Well, I do know my answer, but I can't reveal it yet. And because that has to do with campaign financing and everything else, you know that. So I can't reveal it yet, but I absolutely know my answer. And we're going to do very well. And people are going to be very happy. Look, you know, I look at cable ratings. I look at the ratings of CNN. They're down 79%. MSDNC is down 64%. I mean, what's going on?
Yeah.
I think they're going to come out endorse me. They'll endorse Donald Trump pretty soon, I think.
They're going to endorse Trump for the ratings, CNN, MSNBC, and the rest.
He did win the straw poll there.
He did win the straw poll at CPAC going away.
He beat DeSantis, yeah.
Don't place too much stock in this. Trump is, you know, pretty good at leveraging the press to his advantage, and this he has to have people believing that he is going to run again or at least seriously contemplating running again because it just adds to his standing and it provides energy to the movement. And that's what he spent a good deal of time talking about is the movement that he sparked, his candidacy sparked. Spent a good time talking about that at CPAC in Dallas. Here are sort of the top lines that he offered.
With the help of everyone here today, we will defeat the radical left, the socialists, Marxists, and the critical race theorists. Whoever thought would be even using that term. We will secure our borders. We will stop left-wing cancel culture. We will restore free speech and fair elections. And we will make America great again. It's very simple. Never forget that the radical left is not the majority in this country. We are the majority, and it's not even close. Mm. It's not even close.
And closing it out thusly.
These are the convictions that define our movement today and must define the Republican Party, which has truly become the party of the working man and woman. The working man, the working woman. That's what's happening. Look how many people are joining. We have a much different party than we had 5 years ago. You were in big trouble, Republicans, and look what's happening. Now, for the next 16 months, we must pour every ounce of our energy into winning a historic victory in the midterms.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. His speech, which is, about an hour and a half, you know, the typical things that grate on me a little bit. There's a little bit too much navel gazing, down a few too many rabbit holes, too much sawing sawdust when it comes to the quote-unquote rigged election that he is wont to talk about. It's poundage, not tonnage, in that area. People know the narrative. His pat line about, you know, this doesn't sit right with me. We'll see what happens. That's enough. People can fill in the blanks.
But people want to know, you know, because a lot of people are worried about higher gas prices, the grocery store inflation that's going on. They want to be reassured. You're like, I'm here for you. And in the future, this is what I could do for you. Well, like, I just want a clear path to see, you know, if he was reelected, if he ran again, what is he going to do for the working man and women?
Well, what you just heard there at the outset, and then he summarized by explicitly calling the party of working people, which I like.
But hasn't that changed when we were kids? It was completely reversed.
It has changed significantly.
And I knew it the second I saw people with, you know, Obama stickers on their Teslas, SUV Teslas.
Well, it's a long time. It's been a long time before that, but certainly, yeah, more sort of public manifestations of it. Sure. Look, this is a much different party than it was 8 years ago when Mitt Romney was the nominee for president. And thank goodness that it is. I don't agree with Trump on some of his economic policies, some of his communication choices, but his direction away from trying to genuflect before the elite to get access to these institutions rather than force a conversation about rethinking these institutions. His posture, Trump's, is exactly right. And the people who support him for that reason are exactly right. And it's a better party with that perspective than it is the tin canning, please clapping your way to political power that is the calling card of the Pierre Delectos of the world. So I like that. There's a lot there. But I mean, one of the things there is just understanding for all the hysteria from Never Trumpers in particular. You know, by the way, Mitch McConnell is still the Senate Republican leader and Kevin McCarthy is the House Republican leader. And there are people, there are long termers like Steve Scalise on the House side and John Thune on the Senate side. I mean, the idea that, oh, there's a purge going on and this and that. No, there's a disagreement going on between establishment types. We can make government work, big government work, and we can continue to grow government as long as we're in charge because we suffer from the same fatal conceit of the left. And those who have a perspective of government at least getting out of, you know, unfortunately, there's still too much appetite for transfer payments, even among Trump voters. But still, the idea that government is rigging the system along with powerful interests in these institutions that provide the foundation of our free society against wiring against people who work for a living and play by the rules. That's a pretty good top line. It's a great value proposition. So Trump, it's not 100% for me, but he is directionally correct. And so are the deplorables behind him.
The adorable deplorables. That's what we call them now.
Well, listen,
because my friend's an adorable deplorable.
This isn't just my distillation, of course. This interesting Twitter storm, a tweet storm that was offered by a blogger who goes by Martyr Maid, whose real name is Daryl Cooper. That was turned into a column over at the American Mind, AmericanMind.org, The Disillusionment of the Deplorables. And he starts out by saying, I've had discussions at this point with a wide range of Trump supporters who believe the 2020 election was fraudulent. I think I can extract a general theory about their perspective. It's also the perspective of most of the people who were at the Capitol on January 6th and probably even that of Trump himself. And he just goes through chapter and verse what we know to be true, which Trump did in part yesterday at CPAC as well. To begin with, the FBI and other intelligence agencies spied on the 2016 Trump campaign using evidence manufactured by the Clinton Foundation, the Clinton campaign. We now know this all involved evidence that was fake from day one. Many of the people who believe in fraud are Tea Party people, the types who give their kids a pocket constitution for their birthday and have founding fathers memes in their bios. To them, the intel community spying on a presidential campaign using fake evidence is a big deal. Everyone involved lied about their involvement as long as they could. This was true with everyone from Brennan and Representative Adam Schiff all the way down the line. In the end, we learned it was all fake, but we only learned key information, including the DNC paid for manufactured evidence, because of a court order. James Comey denied on TV knowing the DNC paid for it when we have emails from a year earlier proving that he knew. At first, many Trump supporters were worried there must be some collusion, Russian collusion, because the media and intelligence agency wouldn't make it up out of nothing. When it was clear they had made it up, people expected a reckoning. When that didn't happen, they shed many illusions about their government. And that's just one of the examples of many illusions about your government when it is knowingly lying to you for the purpose of marginalizing you and treating a candidate you support as a threat to democracy so as to keep you in your place. Yeah, that's a real thing.
That whole tweet string people should read. And Tucker Carlson read through the whole thing. It was 8 minutes long on the air, but it was worth it. Then there was one portion, too, that say, you know, making up that there was golden showers in Russia, that he was some kind of, you know, operative with Putin. The whole thing is, it's so spot on.
Again, this is not new. These are things that you've heard on this show
right. For
years now, literally years.
But people need to be remembered or reminded, excuse me.
Yeah, and it's nice to get, nice sort of handy dandy, concise distillations of the last 5 years. This is a pretty good one. Another aspect of it here, the lies from the media. Bob from Buffalo Grove called about the D.C. press corps. He, talking about the deplorables martyr made, writes, they could have managed the shock of knowing the government was purposely lying to them and using the government to go after a political candidate they support. Using the government to go after a political candidate at all. Using intelligence services for politics at all. Yeah, that's a problem for those who believe in a free society. But he writes, they could have managed that shock if it only involved the government. But the behavior of the corporate press is really what radicalized them. They hate journalists more than they hate any politician or government official because they feel most betrayed by them. The idea that the press is driven by ratings and sensationalism became untenable. If that were true, they'd be all over the Jeffrey Epstein story. The corporate press is the propaganda arm of the regime they now see in outline. Nothing anyone says will ever make them unsee that, period. This is profoundly disorienting. Many of them don't know for certain whether ballots were faked in November 2020, but they know for absolute certain that the press, the FBI, would lie to them if there was. They have every reason to believe that, and it's probably true. They watched the press behave like animals for 4 years. Tens of millions of people will always see Brett Kavanaugh as a gang rapist based on nothing because of CNN. And CNN seems proud of that. They led a lynch mob against a high school kid. They cheered on a summer of riots. Yeah, this goes well beyond liberal bias. This goes well beyond, they're just, sensationalists chasing a buck and chasing ratings. It's exactly what he said. And it's just a reminder. And Trump offered that reminder at CPAC yesterday. And this is a serious thing. So to some extent, Trump is problematic in because he creates such a spectacle all the time. He distracts attention away from these real substantive underlying issues. And he did a decent job articulating them, some of them yesterday. I wish he'd have the message focus of this blogger, tweeter. But regardless, he is the vehicle to address the issues that are outlined by this blogger. Or he's one of the vehicles. He's not the only one, but he's one of them. And he was a former president of the United States, so he's a big one. And this is why he has staying power. It's not because of his wonderful personality or his hijinks at rallies. It's because of these underlying substantive issues that never Trumpers like to try and ignore. Vince in St. Charles, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, guys. The thing about President Trump, he's bringing a lot of the private union guys to him. And I wish a lot of people would understand, okay, instead of beating up the union. I mean, not the public union, I get that. But just open your heart a little bit to the private union. Not President Trump and his people around him get it, but say that you're a little bit more receptive of union, private union. Maybe I'm missing it, and maybe they should do it a little bit better, or and then they would get a lot of these old school guys. I get a lot of my friends, a lot of old school guys that are coming to President Trump. There are a lot of us.
Yeah, right.
But they need to show that they're not, because these old school guys, no matter what I tell them, they just don't want to hear it. They don't get it. And I don't, they're just out of touch to it. But maybe if they just open their heart a little bit, you know, like the people, you know, like the Cruz, Ted Cruz of the world, you know, I don't know if he's, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah, I get what you're saying. Thanks for the call. But, you know, I mean, part of it is, let's just be honest. You know, with the private sector units, I've been in Illinois politics for 25 years. I've had many a conversation. Look, we appreciate we can work together on school choice. Trade unions are pro-school choice. In fact, they're driving the Opportunity Scholarship Program in Illinois, for example. Good. Operating engineers and a lot of other trade unions, they're huge Second Amendment guys. Definitely agree on that. We can agree on a right to collectively bargain. There's no problem. You know, some of the other stuff where they want guarantees? No. I mean, on pension reform, those private sector unions, if their business managers manage pensions the way the state does, they'd all be in prison, and they deserve to be in prison. Unfortunately, the politicians deserve to be in prison, too, but they're not going. So there's a lot of areas of agreement. But then you have to be honest to say, you know, this some of the stuff where you take, you want this entitlement or you want this guaranteed wage level or some of these other things, we're going to disagree. But it's not because we're trying to destroy private sector unions. We just have to be honest. You have an honest conversation, and there's going to be points of agreement and points of disagreement, like with any constituency. Just be adult about it. The Republican Party, particularly in Illinois, wants to just suck up and just, I'll do whatever anybody wants me to do as long as they give me campaign cash. Well, nobody respects that, including people you're willing to be a toady for. Nobody respects that. Have some respect for yourself, and then people will respect you. And that's a way to approach non-traditional constituencies for the GOP, like trade unions. Totally agree. Thanks, Frank. I mean, Vince. Frank on the north side.
Hey, Frank.
Oh. Hey, Prof.
Mm-hmm.
You said that the girl wore a backpack, so the guy shot her in half. The way you positioned it, that he was felt threatened. Is that what you were saying?
I'm saying that is something we've heard from law enforcement in the context. She's coming through. She's breaching that door down the hall from the well where there were still allegedly, I don't know all the details, this is the reporting on this, that there were still members of Congress that were, you know, within shouting distance from the mob. She's got a backpack. You don't know what's in that backpack. She's coming through the window, and you've got a gun trained on you, so you know you're supposed to stop, obviously. And so was that a justified shooting despite the fact that she was not obviously armed? It's an open question. We've debated, including with law enforcement, Frank.
So all the other guys, people that were walking through, which were taller than her and bigger than her, who were walking through with backpacks and protective gear on, they weren't threatening. So the guy.
No, she was the first one through in that hallway. That was a different.
Area. So a backpack now. Is the, I mean, where, I don't know who you mentored on her for your law school or in your first law firm. Maybe it was the guy from Seinfeld, Jackie, who represented Kramer. I mean, really? Really? A backpack.
Okay, Frank, thanks for the call. You have people there that are engaged in disruption. You have people that are
using poles to hurt officers, stampeding. 65 Capitol Police officers were injured.
Yeah, confrontations with police. And then you have somebody coming through that window, through that door, in a place where perhaps she, if she got through and other people got through, could have access to members of Congress and Capitol Police, obviously sworn to protect members of Congress and the public in general, but not the law-abiding public. And so was lethal force justified? Well, that was the conclusion that was made, number one, because the officer's not facing disciplinary action. You'll note. I know there's a wrongful death suit filed by the Babbitt family, and that's fine. That's their right to do so. I'm saying
we should find out more information, but you can't even FOIA anything because they're Capitol Police.
I'm saying this is a tough call. I don't think it's as obvious as just she's unarmed, he's armed, and so he shouldn't have shot her. You don't know exactly what was said because it was loud, even with the video there. You have a gun trained on you by a police officer, and you're going to come at that police officer? Is that the play? I don't think it's the play. So I can make a case for either side, Frank, even though you want to denigrate my law degree. That's what you learn to do in law school. And I think this is a close call. I really do. And you can disagree. That's fine. Alan on 55. Go ahead.
I wanted to make a little... We're talking about the Capitol and all that, and here's the problem I see. If they want to make it a state, what's going to happen to, quote, MDW? Have you ever heard that term?
Say that again. What's going to happen to what?
MDW. That's Military District of Washington, which covers everything up there, and is guarded by the United States military, which is why you cannot get to the stuff that you are looking for from the Sergeant of Arms and all that other stuff. The Capitol Police all come under those classified regulations that take care of the MDW, the Military District of Washington, yeah, which is D.C.
Thanks for the call. Well, yes, and this is consistent with the Paul Sperry investigative report that we referenced earlier. So members of Congress have dominion over the Capitol Police. So they can change the rules by which the Capitol Police live with respect to FOIA, with respect to public access to misconduct records. And that should be part of this conversation, shouldn't it? Since we're examining the Capitol Police's performance on January 6th, in the larger context of everything that transpired and who did what with what responsibility, it seems an opportune time to have that discussion as well, doesn't it?
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You sure you want to stick with the government school system? Are you positive? All right. CDC promulgated guidance Friday calling for a return to in-person learning for children, regardless of whether all of the prevention strategies can be implemented at the school. Still advancing the notion that unvaccinated children should continue to wear masks in school. The update of the bullet points from CDC, which was just rinsed and repeated by Illinois Department of Public Health, of course, is 3-foot distance between students in classrooms. Now it was 6, now it's 3.
And 3 is normally, by the way, the normal space between desks is 3 feet.
Combined with indoor mask wearing by people who are not fully vaccinated to reduce transmission risk. Oh, by the way, that Duke study that found that, and it's not the only one, found social distancing had no impact on transmission.
Zero. Yeah. Same with surface-to-person transmission.
Oh.
Never happened. Not one case in the world of touching a computer and then getting COVID.
Masks to be worn by all individuals over the age of 2 who are not vaccinated, even though at present the emergency use of the vaccines is not even authorized for people under 12. All individuals under the age of 2, not fully vaccinated, wear masks. You looking forward to sending Sally and Jimmy back to your government school system come the fall? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636DA, turnkey.pro. Text line. Now, remember, this is guidance from CDC, rinsed and repeated by IDPH. So, obviously, school districts can make a different choice, but you know most of them won't.
Well, Vandalia School District, their superintendent came out and said, if you're vaccinated, we're not going to be wearing masks. that state, another, the Red Hill School Board, they've decided not to wear. In Southern and Central Illinois.
Most. This is what Tammy Prentice over at Hinsdale District 86 was waiting for. Tell me what to do. We can't figure it out. Okay. Now you got your marching orders. I'm sorry, guidance. That'll be received as marching orders.
Well, in California, they made up their mind right after the CDC said that. They said, nope, regardless of the recommendations from the CDC, every student in the state of California is going to be required to wear masks when school reopens in the fall.
There you go. Of course.
The whole state, even in areas that had one or two cases, because there's a lot of rural areas of California, they're supposed to wear masks.
Why shouldn't the COVIDians continue doing what they've been doing? Why not? What's the consequence?
Because there should be a reward, a carrot at the end of the stick. They keep saying, get vaccinated, all these new variants. And if you do, then you get a reward by not being masked or tested at school, because it's more about the masks. What CPS offered on Friday, they didn't do it. They did not describe if we're going to be having masks or not at this point, but more contact tracing, testing healthy kids during the school hour. Kids stick their own swab up their nose now, not the SEIU people.
Have you figured out yet? Have you figured this out yet?
Oh, I figured it out.
No, I don't think you have. Have you figured this part of it out? When you're the mouse in the maze, you don't get to make the rules. There should be this and there should be that. Well, who are you? You're a mouse in the maze looking for your cheese. We'll put the cheese in the maze if we decide to. And when we decide to. Until then, you're just a mouse in a maze. We're not really interested in you. And so that's what this is. What are you going to do about it?
The contact tracing is what really bothers me.
What are you going to do about it?
I want to try to leave, but I can't leave.
Okay.
Well,
what are people going to do about it? I mean, that is basically the question that is put to you with an index finger poking you in the chest every single day by the COVIDians in this state. And as you see, as you heard with respect to California, by the COVIDians in lockdown states, the lockdown enthusiasts. Gavin Newsom, you think he fears a recall? Doesn't sound like it, does it? So I've said this for, I don't know, since the beginning. If there are no electoral consequences for the decisions that were made and the impacts they had, then those decisions will continue. Even when there is less hysteria and less of an evidentiary basis because so much more is known, to continue them. And so that's what's happening.
In Antioch District 117, they're asking but not requiring parents to provide proof of their children's COVID-19 vax. To see whether or not, how many people are vaccinated. Do we have to wear a mask? CPS released that 78% of teachers have been vaccinated. Isn't this about protecting them since the kids are such low health risks for this? And that if they get it, you don't need me to repeat it. 99.99999999.
You want to have a conversation on data and science with people that don't care about the data and science. They use data and science as a punchline to punch you in the face, basically. We're relying on the experts and the data and the science. That's the extent of the distillation of the data and the science that you get from Triple Threat, that you get from Jelly Belly, because you know why? That's all they need to say. Why say more? Why go out on a limb?
Well, why can't parents call, email, telegram your school board superintendent about masks, about freeing our kids' faces?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, how many viral videos do you need of kids addressing their school boards? In some places, it just doesn't resonate. You just can't penetrate, can you? Or am I missing something? Please tell me what's going on in suburban Chicago in particular. The city is a joke, and it's lost, and it's a useless exercise to even have a conversation about it. CPS is one of the worst government school systems in the Western Hemisphere, and it's just descended deeper into the madness during COVID. It was lost a long time ago. Hate to break it to you. The suburbs, though, all those schools, again, that enjoy these reputations because, you know, you went there and now your kids go there. I grew up here and it was such a great school when I grew up, so I assume it's the same. Is it? I mean, 90% of parents, including most conservative parents, most conservatives who have kids school age, send their kids to government school system. What are you going to do?
My friend who has a follow the science, unmask the kids sign in her yard, stolen over the weekend. Others in Arlington Heights and Evanston's, theirs were stolen too.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636DA, turnkey.pro text line. Chris and Carrie, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, good morning. I'm really glad you brought this up, Dan, because on Saturday, I believe it was, we received, because my wife is a teacher, information from the schools, and they're, you know, always crowing about CDC, follow the CDC, or you use them as guidance. But they somehow changed the verbiage in there. From, I think if you read that, it says should. Should is not a definite. Should just means we'd like you to, basically. But our school district changed it to must. Uh-huh. So, and I think they got a bunch of emails, but you better watch out, because if you release this to the parents and they're paying attention, should is not must.
Well, should
and it, you better, and so they walked it back. Luckily, they walked it back.
Oh, they
it
did.
It worries me that. Well, it worries me that come when, it comes to school time, they're going to go must. And that's what's really disheartening.
Yeah, I agree. Thanks for the call, Chris. I mean, what have we seen over the last 18 months? Should and must are treated as synonyms by the COVIDians. Should and must are synonyms. When the CDC says should or the IDPH says should, that's translated down stream to must by teachers union controlled school districts. Of course it is. Brian in Oak Forest.
Hey, good morning. I just sent you an email, Dan, of what I plan on sending off to all my local officials from cities, villages, school districts, townships, etc. So please give it a read. Let me know, because obviously I want to be accurate and I want to get my point across. So all I got today. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Brian. Again, by the way, that study out of Merry Old England that we mentioned on Friday in our conversation with Jeffrey Tucker from the American Institute for Economic Research.
Mm-hmm.
470,000 kids infected in England. Study of 470,000 kids, largest of its kind. 21 deaths are attributed directly to COVID. Now, again, every death is a tragedy, but it's like we talk about in this country where you have a few hundred children under the age of 18 who have died from COVID.
Three here in Chicago.
And that's out of 45,000 children who died during that time period. You know, context, consequence, proportionality. I know these are fighting words to the COVIDians. But, I don't know what to tell you. I don't know what to tell you. If I was sending my kid to a government school and I couldn't get anywhere with the lunkheads on the school board or in the administration, who are probably beholden to the teachers union, which is normally the case, and thus the problem, I'd have a hard time justifying sending my kid back to that school.
I know.
Real hard time.
Well, can I just quickly, this is what CPS handed out on Friday afternoon, mentions nothing of masks. CPS will continue to implement evidence-based health and safety protocols. Here's what they are. Enhanced cleaning, hand sanitizer and disinfectant wipes for students and staff, rigorous air quality and ventilation standards, including, HEPA, expanded contact tracing, and ongoing school and district-wide safety committees. Well, that's what we need, another committee, huh? Mm. But nothing in there about masks.
Cassandra in Ravenswood.
Hello. This may prove that I'm dumb as a box of rocks, but how can somebody who received the gene therapy or the vaccines ever be threatened by somebody who hasn't? Aren't they admitting that these are not necessarily effective?
And well, they're, I mean, you know, they're nothing's 100%, but they would say that, yes, it reduces the likelihood dramatically, but nothing's 100%, right?
Oh, well.
That's what they would say. And that's, well, that's true, as far as we know.
As far as we know, but it's like a sociological experiment. Let's keep this generation masked and see what happens to them. It's very... I'm embarrassed by how stupid people are that, unlike you, aren't saying, well, what is this all about? And they're going, oh, you know, let me mask up my kid and send it back to Haven Public School in Evanston.
Well,
that's ridiculous.
Thanks for the call, Cassandra.
Kids need to breathe.
Remember what Einstein said. The difference between genius and stupidity is that genius has its limits. And I think we're finding out that that's true.
And they're scaring us with, you know, different variants. Now we've got, you talked about the Epsilon. Now we got the Lambda. Dr. Alison Awardi tweeted, Lambda variant. It was originally detected in Peru and recently labeled as a variant of interest. At this point, it has not been named a variant of concern. It has been detected in the U.S., including Illinois.
Yeah.
We're continuing to monitor it.
I think
then she wrote, want to prevent more variants? Get vaxxed.
I think she is putting Lewis Skolnick and the Adams College guys on that. That Lambda variant. See if they can figure that out.
The Lambda, you mean?
Yeah, everybody except for Lambda, Lambda, Lambda.
Here's one who'll see us.
Lambda, Lambda, Lambda. Lambda.
We're going to go through the entire Greek alphabet before this is over with.
That's a curious Revenge of the Nerds drop that you
picked.
Yes,
it is.
You know, it's funny. It's a good reminder of one of Dan Prof's axioms of human existence. Mm-hmm. Women aren't funny.
Oh, wow. Oh, and you are? Why don't you go tell another golf joke while you're at it then? 312-642-5600. They love them.
It's just like, what that?
it was the Delta, now it's the Lambda. That's the plan.
Delta, Epsilon. And
Epsilon, remember, the Epsilon's in the back pocket. When the Delta is not scaring people enough, they're going to whip that up.
Yeah, thank you. I got it. I've been able to follow this thread. All right. So speaking of the vaccinations, you know how they're not literally going to go door to door. They're going to go door to door. They're not going to go door to door. They are going to go door to door because it's the government's business. That's what HHS Secretary Becerra said.
Yeah.
Well, they are going to go door to door. And very own Lake County, Illinois, already has some draft scripts for your COVID ambassador. Your local COVID ambassador.
This is unbelievable, you guys.
All right.
You've got to listen up.
All right. Don't oversell it.
This is pretty intrusive.
Why? They're knocking on your door. They're not.
No soliciting signs.
They're not budging. They're not barging in. All right. So I'll be the.
We've gone over this.
You be the property manager. We'll let you be one of the ambassadors.
Okay.
We'll let you be the COVID ambassador, and I'll be the property manager.
Okay.
All right. So property manager. There you go. Here's the script that's been drafted with your tax dollars there in Lake County. Congratulations on that.
Are we starting right here?
Yeah.
Okay. Right,
you're the property manager. You're the COVID ambassador, and I'm the property manager.
Okay. Hello. My name's Amy Jacobson. I'm a community health ambassador with the Lake County Health Department. How are you today?
Do you see this gun pointed at you? Leave my property. No, that's not what it says. Good, but busy. What can I do for you?
Well, I'd like to come by your property to see if your seniors need any information regarding the COVID vaccine, and I'd like to come by tomorrow at 10 a.m.
We don't allow solicitation or former network affiliate reporters on our property.
Stop. Well, I understand, but I'm not selling anything. We want to provide accurate information to the seniors in our community. Our goal is to maximize the vaccination effort so that all of our seniors receive the COVID vaccine when the clinic comes on site. All I want is to see your seniors protected against COVID. I'm just trying to help.
We've been hearing about a vaccine clinic forever. When is it going to happen, and will the Rona Busters be there for the ribbon cutting?
Well, they won't be, but it's going to happen soon, and that's why we'd like to access your property to talk with your tenants to get them prepared for that day. The pharmacy providers chosen by the Illinois Department of Public Health are working to get you on the schedule at the earliest opportunity.
My residents are very skeptical about strangers and politicians, or at least they should be. They're concerned about getting scammed during this vulnerable time.
Well, again, we're not selling anything. Mm-hmm. We would just ask them if they're interested in getting the vaccine, and if not, why not? Many do not have access to the reliable sources, blah, blah, blah. We just want to get in as many seniors vaccinated to keep them and your community safe. So what's the best process to follow up in order to access the building tomorrow at 10 a.m.?
What information will you need from the residents, and will you be taking guardianship of them and stealing their assets?
Absolutely. We don't need any information. Absolutely nothing.
No, of course.
I won't be asking for any personal information. I don't even need to know their names. I just want to see if they have any questions or concerns about mm-hmm. getting the vaccine that I can answer, and to provide them really with any information they need.
Well, that all sounds stupendous. When you get here, you can ring Mr. Smith in apartment 401 because we hate him.
Well, that's perfect. Thank you.
Yeah. I am added some of my own commentary there, but this is literally a draft script that is on the Lake County Health Department website. Congratulations, Lake County Government, leading the way.
And it's so funny, like knock and then back up. So knock on the door, back up. Even if they've been vaccinated, leave them information. Mm-hmm. Use your script. Leave the flyer, even if they've been vaxxed. Do not leave anything in a mailbox. That is illegal if you're not a mail carrier.
Oh, that's great.
Hate to be arrested for mail fraud.
That's great. All right, now the other one here. The direct conversation with the senior here.
Okay.
No, so you're the health ambassador.
All right, tell me when you're ready.
Go ahead.
I have the door knob. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. Hello, my name is Amy Jay, and I'm a community health ambassador with the Lake County Health Department. The reason I'm here today is to talk to you about the COVID vaccine. Have you received a COVID vaccine already?
Get off my lawn.
I'm going to give you to the count of 10 to get your ugly, yellow, no good keister off my property before I pump your guts full of lead.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. Online at 560theanswer.com, on the AM560 mobile app, on your Alexa-powered smart speaker, and on TuneIn, iHeart, and on Odyssey. Let freedom ring this afternoon at 2 with Sean Hannity on AM560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. I grew up in the suburbs. I live in the city. So, I've been around the state quite a bit, though, running campaigns, being a candidate.
And you never left the state. I mean, you went to North undergrad, got your JD here, Northwestern Loyola.
I know.
You need a brand. You can go west of the Mississippi, you know, there, son.
I've been there, but I'm more concerned about rural communities in Illinois. There are many. You know, you get an hour outside of Chicago, and it's quite a different state. Lovely state, actually.
It's free.
But I'm concerned about all of these hillbillies that live in rural enclaves.
Because, I don't think they want to be called hillbillies because they're not. Smart. Some of the smartest people I know are farmers.
They're all slack-jawed yokels. That's what I understand from the political ruling class and people that are very concerned about them like I am, like Reparation H's.
Oh, she is?
And so these voting ID laws, especially when it comes to mail-in ballots, have you thought about these poor, ignorant, rural residents who don't even have access to a Kinko's?
People are talking about potential compromises. Mm-hmm. Is agreeing to voter ID one of those compromises that you'd support?
I don't think that we should underestimate what that could mean. Because in some people's mind, that means, well, you're going to have to Xerox or photocopy your ID to send it in to prove you are who you are. Well, there are a whole lot of people, especially people who live in rural communities, who don't. There's no Kinko's. There's no Office Max near them. People have to understand that when we're talking about voter ID laws, be clear about who you have in mind and what would be required of them to prove who they are.
Yeah. It can't end up being able to photocopy their ID to the extent they even manage to figure out how to get a driver's license or government ID.
Do they even know where the DMV is?
I mean, they can barely wash themselves. Now you want them to photocopy their ID to send it in to mail and vote?
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 646-36, type in DA, then a quick comment. How insulting. First, they insult the African-American community by saying, you know, again, that they don't know where the DMV is. They don't have a computer. And if they did, do they even know how to log on to the internet? And now the Biden administration is saying this. Farmers and those in rural communities, they don't know how to make photocopies of things, or they don't know, can't go to a Kinko's or a FedEx. No one has copy machines.
Well, I think it's nice.
Grundy County.
I think it's nice that our betters, like Kamala Harris, obviously goes without saying that she is a dizzying intellect. One of the smartest people in the country.
She's in way over her head.
Joe Biden, President of the United States, another brilliant guy. Smart people. These are smart people in charge. And they recognize that we're not as smart, especially you in rural communities or you in minority, majority neighborhoods in big cities. You know, all the dumb people in America, all the people that can't take care of themselves, that, you know, don't have utensils.
Oh, that's right.
That you know, they live like animals. They don't know, but that doesn't mean they shouldn't come out and vote, that they should lose their franchise. And so Kamala Harris is trying to exhibit her concern. It's not just for dumb minorities in big cities. It's also for dumb rural people. And, you know, like there's food deserts in big cities. There's photocopy deserts in rural communities. And this is a big problem when it comes to voting. So I understand it from somebody who's smarter than us. Don't you think?
This is so insulting on a number of levels. I'd love to hear from farmers or people in rural communities. You know,
it's if they can figure out how to use a phone.
Oh, yeah. And teachers at schools, there's no copy machines there. Hello.
Yeah. For you who live in rural areas, if you want to scrawl us a note on it with crayons and figure out how to mail it into us,
or
then we'll read
carrier.
It on the air in a couple of weeks.
Pigeon carrier, that would work too.
Yeah. This was a case too. The good news is that this is why there shouldn't be any sort of identification or laws, qualifications, regulations regarding voting, because, I mean, there's no fraud. There's no evidence of fraud with all of these expansions that the Democrat Socialists want, including federalizing elections. Texas Governor Greg Abbott was on with Chris Wallace yesterday, and Chris Wallace pressed him on this. These voter fraud investigations going on in places like Texas, isn't this just a solution in search of a problem?
Absolutely not, Chris. Remember this, and that is before that I was governor. I was the Attorney General of Texas, and I prosecuted voter fraud cases across the entire state. And my successor, Kim Paxson, has been prosecuting voter fraud across the state, including the most recent arrest and indictment just taking place this past Friday. However, I have to disagree with the statement that was just made, as well as the public perception, because I'm going to give you the words of a federal district judge appointed by Barack Obama. And the federal district judge said that voter fraud occurs, quote, in abundance as it involves ballot harvesting. On top of that, Barack Obama and the Biden administration, when they were in office, they came down to the state of Texas to send an FBI team as well as a U.S. attorney to investigate and to prosecute a voter fraud scheme where cocaine was being used to buy absentee ballots. I will tell you this also, Chris, and that is even Democrats in the Texas House of Representatives, they agree that as it concerns mail-in ballots, that is an area where improving the mail-in ballot system is a way to achieve greater election integrity. So what Texas is doing is we're making it easier to vote by adding more hours of early voting than we had in current law, but also making it harder to cheat with regard to mail-in ballots.
Yeah. And oh, by the way, on the ballot harvesting count, we reported last week New York Democrats want state election officials to investigate alleged ballot harvesting by a city council candidate in New York City, a Republican city council candidate. So wait, ballot harvesting. I thought they were all offended that prohibition of ballot harvesting was upheld by the Supreme Court as it pertains to the Arizona law. Ballot harvesting is not a big deal. Ballot harvesting, prohibiting it is just a way to disenfranchise minorities and perhaps apparently some hillbillies out there in the hustings. But then you got a problem when you believe a Republican candidate for city council in New York City was engaged in a ballot harvesting campaign. Huh. Gosh. Dude, these leftists who are saving our democracy, they're just inscrutable, aren't they? By the way, in Texas, the attorney general there, Ken Paxton, is investigating, according to his office, nearly 400 additional cases of voter fraud. He told the audience at CPAC, in addition to the indictments that were handed down recently against some dozen or so people who were alleged to have engaged in voter fraud in the 2020 election. But that wasn't good enough for Chris Wallace, being the dogged interrogator that he is. The expanded early voting hours, but making it more difficult to commit fraud. What about 24-hour voting and drive-through voting? Why oppose 24-hour voting?
That is so ridiculous.
Why oppose drive-through voting?
Yeah, they had that. It was big in Houston last time around.
Well, Governor, let me ask you, though, about two other things that the GOP bills would do. I want to put them up on the screen. They would ban 24-hour voting, and they would ban drive-through voting. Now, there was no allegation of any fraud in either of those. Harris County, the Houston area, employed both of those, and more than half of the voters who showed up were people of color. So you say you want to make it easier to vote. That's going to make it harder to vote. And the question is, why make it harder for some Texans to vote unless the point is to suppress voting by people of color?
So you mentioned a couple of things that need to be responded to. One, you mentioned how Harris County did this, and it was Harris County alone. And for your viewers, Harris County is where Houston, Texas is located. Let's go back to Article 1, Section 4 of the United States Constitution, where it says in there that it is the states, not counties, that have the authority to regulate elections. And despite that constitutional mandate, this past election, Harris County, a county, tried to create its own election system that had never been used in the state of Texas. It was not used in other parts of the state of Texas. And so what
but
the
Governor,
state
why
of
not,
Texas
why not
is doing...
Why not let it go on? Governor,
I can give you some
I guess the question is, if 24-hour voting worked, why not continue it?
Well, first, I'm going to answer your question specifically, but you need to go back to elections before now, because the same allegations were made when Texas passed a voter ID law, and everyone said the exact same thing. This is going to disenfranchise people of color. It will reduce voting. And the fact of the matter is, after we passed voter ID, we increasingly saw every election cycle, more people go vote. It did not make it harder to go vote. It was easier to go vote. And the same thing applies here, and that is, with 24-hour voting, one thing that we want to make sure that we have is integrity in the ballot box system, and we need to have poll watchers and monitors. And candidly, it's hard even for a county to get people to be watching the polls 24 hours a day. We are providing more hours per day for voting to make sure that anybody of any type of background, any type of working situation is going to have the opportunity to go vote.
I guess Texas doesn't have any rural areas if they saw an increase in turnout. I guess they don't have any majority neighborhoods in places like Houston or Dallas or Austin, because how else would you explain an increased turnout despite these prohibitive voting ID laws? Because, again, more from Kamala Harris on rural people.
You've got to remember that these are just simple farmers. These are people of the land. The common clay of the New West. You know. Morons.
What are we supposed to do? What are we supposed to do about these morons? I tell you, boy.
They went from deplorables to morons. Yeah.
I'm more and more persuaded by Kamala Harris. I appreciate that she's trying to make sure that Trump voters in rural areas are right. able to vote. Yeah. Frank in Arlington Heights.
Good morning. Well, first of all, on the door knockers, I got a different response than the one you had, Dan, share from the movie mask as Rusty Dennis. None of your goddamn business.
That's not bad.
Not great.
Not bad. Not bad.
She's a horrible actress, a good singer.
Well, she's an Academy Award winner. Be careful.
Oh, okay. All right. But on voter fraud, it's absolutely imperative we have voter ID. I mean, voter fraud has been going on. Voter fraud, really more election fraud, has been going on in this country really forever. I mean, voting used to be, as I'm sure you're aware, before we had the secret ballot, just, you know, open-ended in caucuses. There was fraud there. In the 1840s, they brought in Arista County, Maine, they brought people across the border to vote in some of the elections there. Of course, 1948 landslide, Lyndon, Duval, and Jim Wells County, there's all kinds of election fraud going on there. You know, this has to be cleaned up if we want to have people have faith in their elections. And I sure don't. Thanks. I don't.
Yeah, what do election days turn into, a casino? 24 hours. Hey, come and vote. 24-hour voting.
Do you know what movie? Cher won the Academy Award for Best.
Moonstruck.
Good. Good. I didn't think you'd get it.
I know.
Not bad. Not bad.
I answered the question before you finished your sentence, sir.
You knew where I was going.
Yes.
Mm. I'm so predictable.
She looks good for her age, though. Not like she hasn't had any 80? Work done.
Yeah. Just no more.
She's 75, I think.
Yeah, just no more dental floss on the deck of a battleship, okay? I want to see that. Mike in Yorkville. Hey, Mike in Yorkville. One of those hillbillies.
And Amy, yes, exactly, from the rural country counties and cities of Illinois.
We can't even operate
our own cell phones.
Exactly.
But, you know, we've understood that Election Day was Election Day, not month, because we realize as patriots we can take the time out to actually come and vote that day. Not think if I can roll out of bed at any moment and maybe figure out how I can go ahead and fraudulently affect the election, just like Chicago has, or the Democrats have since, what, the Civil War?
Yeah. Hey, do you guys have like an Office Depot or a Kinko's or anything out Yorkville way where you can
FedEx
make a photocopy of your driver's license?
Yeah, so we have FedEx, Kinko's, UPS, driver's license,
really?
Bureau place out here. We have
so
Walmarts, we have Targets, we have Portillo's.
You have Portillo's? Wow. Do you have Starbucks?
The world out in Yorkville went and got himself in a big damn hurry. Margo in Burr Ridge.
Hi. Well, you know, I was kind of shocked that the governor of Texas was talking about Barack Obama trying to solve fraud in Texas, because what I remember is when he was in office, there was a woman named Lois Lerner at the IRS who sent the DEA, the FBI, and the ATF to Texas, and she sicked them on a woman named Catherine Engelbrecht.
Yeah.
Catherine Engelbrecht
threw the vote.
She couldn't figure out why there was all these Democrats in her precinct, so she got the voter rolls. And the first day, she goes to an address where there's 600 Democrats registered, and all of them had voted in the previous three presidential elections. It was an open field. So she found it through the vote, and Lois Lerner made her pay for it big time. Now, she eventually won her lawsuit, but that's what I remember about Barack Obama and truing the vote in Texas.
Well, very good. Thanks for the call, Margo. Joe in Naperville.
Yeah, you know, why do these Democrats continue to put up these fake straw men? Why don't they give me, you know, why don't they ask Kamala Harris, well, give me the name of five people that wouldn't be able to vote. And let's put this person under oath. Let's have him be cross-examined to see if this is really a true issue or it's not. And I'm going to guess that it's not.
Thanks, Joe.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Michael Moore's movie, was it called Sicko? His documentary on the wonders of the Cuban healthcare system. Well, he's just got to be stunned at what is transpiring in Cuba, that communist island. New York Times reporting, in the way only the New York Times could, shouting freedom and other anti-government slogans. Hundreds of Cubans took to the streets in cities around the country on Sunday to protest food and medicine shortages.
Yeah, what? They want the vaccine, too.
Medicine shortages in Cuba?
What?
The People's Revolution that came to Cuba and turned it into a utopia for the working man? Medicine shortage, remarkable eruption of discontent not seen in nearly 30 years.
Yeah, 32 cities protested at the same time.
Freedom and other anti-government slogans.
A lot of them were carrying American flags, too. More patriotic than
freedom and other anti-government slogans. Huh. I think that's sort of unintentionally accurate. You say anti-government. I say crying freedom is pro-natural law. Boy, I bet when people shout freedom, whether it's in Hong Kong or Havana, really bothers the New York Times, which is a good representative of the thinking of the radical left.
And they're chanting to No Tenemos Miedo, which means we are not afraid.
Wonderful. They should be chanting death to the state. Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano joins us, VP of the Catherine and Shelby Cullen Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation, author of the recently released Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, let's start in our hemisphere. What's going on with the Cuban people?
So when incidents like this happen, I always think of the really fabulous book that Natan Sharansky wrote several years ago called The Case for Democracy, and where he contrasts free regimes with authoritarian regimes in Cuba. And the thing that he really describes so well is that these regimes are not sustainable over time. But you can never predict whether it's the French Revolution or the Russian Revolution, you know, exactly when a regime is going to collapse, because by their nature, because they're so authoritarian, information isn't shared. There's very little transparency. They have these very rigorous, but sometimes very fragile security infrastructures. And so, you know, not to be crude, but it's kind of like a building collapses. Everything looks fine. And then when there's a roofing drop. So, is the regime actually in danger here? Well, it's very, very difficult to tell because they have an incredibly robust security architecture. But the question is will those guys, you know, be loyal to the regime, go to the street, or, you know, will they do like sometimes happens, takes off their jacket, you know, and join the people in the street?
And what should
the one thing that we absolutely know for sure, without question, is these regimes are despicable. And people that embrace them and loud them and want to engage and empower them, like Obama did when he opened up to Cuba, they don't even listen to the people of the country, like in Iran or Cuba. They hate the people that govern them. They hate the systems that they live under. And when we make excuses for them or empower them, or even like in Michael Moore's stupid movie, kind of glorify them, you know, we're not aiding the cause of freedom. We're actually diminishing it.
What could, or I mean, maybe what should is a pointless exercise given the posture of the Obama administration. But what could we do if we had an administration that wanted to support the interests of freedom fighters, whether, as I said, in Hong Kong or Havana?
Well, the first thing we could do is very robustly, immediately come out and strongly state that we stand with the Cuban people, which this administration didn't do. I think it's just a complete and utter embarrassment that literally the White House has been silent on this, and the State Department put out this thing, well, oh, they just needed more vaccine. So we've already kind of failed. But, you know, it's never too late to recover. So the first thing the administration should do is say, we stand with the Cuban people. Mm-hmm. The second thing is they should put out a very stern warning to the Cuban government that the one thing that we completely and absolutely would not tolerate was another vote would be what they did the last time, was we just throw them all on boats and send them to the United States. Puts those people at risk. It's very dangerous. You know, stopping those boats at sea and turning them back is very, very difficult. So I think those are two messages that we should be putting out like right away.
Well, I mean, Cubans, thousands of them, in 32 cities throughout Cuba were chanting freedom and down with communism, as you heard us discuss. But do you think that this is a cry for more vaccines, or there might be a coup d'etat?
Well, clearly it's a lot bigger than vaccines. clearly this is just the people are just fed up with this despicable authoritarian government. And, you know, the good news is it's a leaderless revolt. Sorry.
Sorry. Are you under assault? Did you run into an Antifa mob? What's happening?
Sorry about that. You know, so, I mean, the good news, I mean, it's a completely leaderless revolt, I mean, which makes it harder to tap down because this wasn't planned or anything. It's much like the, in Venezuela. But the downside of that is it's a leaderless revolt, which means that there is no organization. There's no sustained infrastructure or logistics. So whether it will, you know, continue or not, I think remains to be seen. But what it clearly demonstrates is this is the genuine feeling of the Cuban people. They hate their government. There is no question about that.
Yeah, the government's blocking their internet, too.
I wanted to go to another totalitarian regime. That would be the Chinese Communist. And this sort of excited utterance from the Deputy Prime Minister of Japan, Taro Aso, who essentially said that if China invades or attacks Taiwan, it will become Japan will then become the next target of China's military, which will endanger Japan's survival. So they stand with Taiwan, and Japan and the U.S. must defend Taiwan together, which is sort of a curious statement to make if you don't feel like Taiwan is under real threat. And the posture of the military brass in this administration has been that Taiwan is under no immediate threat. So who's right?
Well, I think we're playing a game of chicken here. I think that the Chinese, I mean, we don't know for sure. I mean, that's kind of the scary thing about this scenario. But I think the Chinese are ramping up the rhetoric. I mean, this is, I think, when I balance, you know, all the people, like, we talk to people in Japan. So on balance, I think what it means is the Chinese are really ramping up the rhetoric because they really want us to talk ourselves into defeat, to just really abandon Taiwan because, oh, my God, might be a conflict with Taiwan. That would be terrible. That could expand. We can have a nuclear war. And what they want us to do is just, you know, fold like a cheap suit and go home. And I think the Japan response is actually correct. Is if we don't want to have a conflict over Taiwan, then what we need to do in response is to make very, very clear that the people of Taiwan and their independence is strategically important to us, to Japan, really to South Korea, and that we stand with the Taiwan people, and we're not going to stand for a military incursion.
I wanted to get to your reaction to something President Trump had to say here in terms of back home at CPAC in Dallas yesterday, talking about the failure to hold anyone in government accountable for what they did during Trump's years in the pursuit of removing Trump from office.
I'm very disappointed that Bill Barr was unable to hold anyone accountable for the countless abuses of power by the Democrats. He didn't hold the corrupt officials who spied on our campaign. Remember, I said, they're spying on our campaign. And boy, that was like a lightning rod went off. Not the authors of the phony dossier, they weren't held responsible. Not the women who slandered and lied and defamed Brett Kavanaugh. They said Brett Kavanaugh, he had an affair. They didn't go after them. They lied so badly. Not any of the numerous criminal referrals for lying to Congress over and over again. Not any of the illegal leakers. Not any of the people that were responsible for corrupting our elections is no greater crime.
And so on and so forth. The continued delegitimizing of the institutions by those in charge of them without the delegitimizing a direct result of not mistakes or bad actors, but the lack of accountability when mistakes or worse are made by individuals that have authority in those institutions.
Well, there's actually a term for this. It's called lawfare, which is where you use legal systems to attack and undermine your political competitors. And I think the president's problem is, by and large, I mean, I'm not a lawyer, so I can't speak to every single instance, but by and large, what people did, use legal mechanisms to try to undermine the president of the United States, and use press freedom and the freedom of speech and the instruments of Congress and even government and the court to go after the president. And so both of these things are true. On the one hand, if you look at the innumerable attacks against the president of the United States, most of them were patently false. Most of them were intentionally done. But I think it's also true that the vast majority, at least as we can tell, are going through legal mechanisms, which means, well, how do you combat this? Well, you combat it at the voting booth, which is where you say, look, we know that these people are playing us, and we vote for the people that we want to. That's why the most critical issue in America today is really these voting bills that the president has put out, which really are a federal takeover of the election system, and which are really designed to put one party in power forever, because that's the ultimate undermining of democracy. When voters can no longer hold you accountable, and when people do this stuff, and they don't fear having to go back to the voters and be accountable for that. So this is a real fight. It's not, why are we putting people in jail? It's, we have to protect the integrity of each and every vote. Otherwise, that is the real threat to future democracy.
He is Lieutenant Colonel Jim Carafano, VP at the Catherine and Shelby Cullum Davis Institute for International Studies at the Heritage Foundation. The book, Brutal War, Jungle Fighting in Papua New Guinea, 1942. Jim, thanks as always.
Yeah. Sorry about the sun, but I think the buffalo has moved on now.
Okay. Very good. Good luck.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. The Democrat nominee for mayor of New York City, and for all intents and purposes, the next mayor of New York City, Eric Adams, was on with Clinton Foundation donor Zero on this week. He had this to say about his victory and what it means for the woke base of the Democrat Socialist Party.
We can't be so idealistic that we're not realistic. Cities are hurting all across America, and New York personifies that pain, the inequalities, the gun violence, the lack of really looking after everyday blue-collar workers, I like to say. And we have failed for so many years, and we've allowed the fallout of the Trump administration to have an overreach in philosophy and not on-the-ground real issues that are facing everyday New Yorkers.
So is it fair to call you an anti-woke Democrat?
No, I've, some of us never went to sleep. That's the problem. You know, a 35-year record of fighting for reform, but public safety, a person who was arrested by police, assaulted by police, but also lost a childhood friend to gang violence. And so I never went to sleep. And people who have finally realized that there are issues out here believe they can carve the entire Democratic agenda.
Uh-huh. CDC data. U.S. homicides in 2020, 24,692, which was an increase of more than 5,500 over 2019. 29% homicides, the majority happening after a spike that coincided with the riots protesting the death of George Floyd, as we know. The data, you know, follow the data and the science. Well, the data and policing is art and science. But it's interesting, the comments by Adams, and we'll see. He is a direct reaction to outgoing Mayor Warren Wilhelm. And so the question is, in other cities, can you get a direct reaction to mayors that are outgoing or should be outgoing? Well, I don't know, like perhaps Triple Threat here in Chicago this weekend. What are the numbers? 42
shot, 10 killed.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And you don't think it's coming to the north side? We had a 22-year-old woman in my block carjacked at gunpoint at 11:57 on Friday night. Gun to her head, took her white BMW. Thank God she didn't get shot. And last night we had 10 rounds fired at Irving Park in Ashland about 10:15 at night.
We had a chance to have a reaction and repudiation of Kim Fox in 2020. That went by the boards. Too soon, I guess. Maybe 2023? Maybe 2023 and 2024 with respect to Triple Threat and Kim Fox?
I mean, Kim Fox, how in the heck did she get elected into
office? We covered the story. We know how she got elected.
But then you have this case over the weekend, you know, that gruesome double murder that went viral after the Puerto Rican Day Parade with Giovanni and his girlfriend Yasmin. Well, they arrested somebody, Anthony Lorenzi, 34. He escaped to San Diego right after the murder, you know, point blank execution style of Anthony, of Giovanni in the head. Everyone saw it, I'm sure. Well, if you look at his arrest record, how the heck was this guy out? He had 26 felony arrests and 7 convictions, including unlawful use of a weapon in 2010. Why was he even out of jail?
Well, again,
and they go and kill again.
Again, the question of who watches the watchman, who prosecutes the prosecutors. It's not just with respect to federal law enforcement, both on the police side as well as on the criminal justice system side, the prosecutor side. But it's the same question locally, and the answer in Chicago so far has been nobody.
I mean, we need a CPD. They need to create a case review unit to report prosecutors and judges that make bad decisions and hold them responsible. And the person that thought of that is Paul Vallis.
Well,
that would be a
isn't
good
that
way
the
to
job
start.
Of the Chicago Press Corps? Oh, yeah. Another failed institution deserving of no legitimacy. Well, in Detroit, which is you know, still ranked as one of the worst urban centers to live.
It used to be a glorious place to live.
Yeah, well, Berry Gordy left, and so did the livability of Detroit. But their recently retired police chief, James Craig, is contemplating a run for high office. He's a Republican, black Republican,
yep.
Former police chief Detroit, looking to potentially run against the Eva Perón of East Lansing next election, Gretchen Whitmer. Now, again, Detroit is not some miracle story. Homicides are up 19% 2020 over 2019. Aggravated assaults increased 27%. Shootings, 53%. And James Craig has some comments on that. But I thought his general commentary in this weekend interview he did in the Wall Street Journal, it was pretty good, pretty spot on, pretty no-nonsense guy. I'm sure you've seen him on some of the cable news networks over the years. He recalls patrolling black neighborhoods early in his career as a cop, realizing how thankful residents were in having someone that they felt they could identify with, his quote. Today, the Detroit Police Department is majority black, but Craig says recruitment and retention have become a struggle in most other departments. Because of the far left. They want to not just defund, they want to dismantle. Detroit hasn't defunded, but other cities cut the police budget at the expense of black officers. And he goes on to say, the largest portion of any police budget is staffing costs. So if you defund police, you're going to reduce staffing. If you have tried to diversify a police department with newer officers, you will tend to lose some of that diversity. First in, first out. Yeah. He recalls, does Craig, he was laid off himself. 2.5 years in as a Detroit officer, along with many other young black cops.
Yep, and then he moved to L.A. for 3 decades and was to be the police chief.
Was there during the riots.
Yeah.
He rejects the charge of systemic racism. If you take a, this is quoting him, if you take a city like Detroit and say African-Americans are more likely to be stopped by police than whites, the answer would be, that's true. Does that mean Detroit police engage in discrimination? No, you have to look at it more in a more practical, realistic way. This is something that folks don't like to talk about, but black-on-black crime does exist, and sadly, in vulnerable communities, it's more common than violent crimes are perpetrated many times by, more times by persons of color against persons of color. I mean, just stating the obvious, but stating the obvious is revolutionary in these times, particularly if you're wearing a police uniform. And his whole perspective is to provide poor, largely minority residents with the same police protection that the more affluent have in and around Detroit. Right, which is the same perspective we have on this show, the same perspective that anybody who is interested in peace on the streets has. And yet, you can't seem to get that perspective through to those ideologues. As Eric Adams said, what did he say? You can't substitute the ideal for the real. You got to deal with the real, too. Not just comfort yourself with your, you know, ideals. He also talked about the spike in non-lethal crimes. He dug into the auto theft and robbery data, discovered the majority of carjackings happened at night at gas stations and liquor stores, which were also magnets for other crimes of opportunity. So he teamed up with local businesses to install a green light sitting outside of the location so residents would know that's a safe place to go. Officers patrolled nearby, and high-definition cameras help police track crimes in real time and respond. It got so popular that neighborhood groups would go to non-green light locations to protest them and say, we're going to start going down the street to the gas station with the green light, so since you don't want to make the investment, we're not coming here. This project, Greenlight Detroit, is credited with seeing carjackings drop by about 300% between 2013 and 2021, and 2020, actually, 2013 to 2020. It's interesting, as opposed to the silliness we do where you throw a press release out and say, for one day or one weekend, we're going to throw cops at gas stations to help seniors pump their gas so as to prevent carjackings that are occurring at gas stations. No, that's not a solution. That is a press event. There's nothing, you know, people recognize if it's just for a fleeting period of time, particularly when you announce it is. But regardless, if you're not serious about it, if there's no sustained effort in advance of a particular public safety measure, that becomes fairly evident to the populace. I hate to break it to those who govern through press releases, which is what we've had here for the last three mayors at minimum in Chicago. I thought the Craig interview was really interesting. I think he'd make a very interesting candidate, particularly in these times. I don't know. Maybe that's what Chicago needs is a law enforcement, somebody with a law enforcement background to take up the cause of running for mayor, or somebody with a law enforcement background who also maybe is a lawyer or, you know, started out as a cop, became a prosecutor. There's lots of those instances where, like the Jack O'Malley type, for example. And you need somebody like that to run against Kim Fox next time she's up in 24. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out with perhaps non-traditional candidates, including Republican candidates or even like an Eric Adams within the Democrat socialist ranks, challenge the ideologues in power that are otherwise invulnerable because these cities have been lost to electoral competition. So maybe at the state level, if it's going to be a Republican, at the big city level, if it's going to be an effective accountability lever, like an Eric Adams in response to two terms of Warren Wilhelm. But it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out and perhaps how many non-traditional candidates for high office mayors and governors come to the fore against the backdrop of this spike in violence that is not subsiding and really shows no signs of subsiding because not because of COVID, but because of personnel. You can't work around the principles, as I'm wont to say, because of the Lightfoots and the Foxes and the Garcettis and the LA Garcon and the London Breeds and the Chesa Boudin in San Francisco and Larry Krasner, the prosecutor in Philadelphia. That's Mosby and the various mayors in Baltimore. Yeah, there's going to be enough of a contingent of people that demand accountability. And, you know, perhaps Eric Adams was the first shot. We're going to see. I'd like to see James Craig. I'd like to see what he could do running statewide in Michigan. So we'll watch that, too.
Hear about the big stories of the day, then talk about them right here on Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, this is such a great story out of Atlanta. Two nurses, one Tia Wimbush, black, the other Susan Ellis, white. Listen to their story and the story of their husbands.
Tia Wimbush and Susan Ellis have worked together for years at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta in the IT department, and they describe themselves as friendly but not friends. But a chance encounter changed all of that.
On the morning they returned to Children's Healthcare of Atlanta last month, Susan Ellis and Tia Wimbush got a pretty raucous surprise welcome back from their coworkers after an extraordinary few months.
You learn a lot about yourself and your resiliency, your faith, your friends, your family.
And to understand the meaning of this moment, you have to go back to the fall of 2019. That's when Tia's husband, Rodney, a McDonough teacher and father of two boys, got sick first at school.
And his blood pressure was at stroke level.
They were told his kidneys were shutting down.
It was an absolute shock. We didn't understand what was being said to us, what the magnitude was, what that meant.
In Peachtree Corner, Susan Ellis's then fiance Lance sensed that his body was rejecting the kidney that his mother had donated to him 2 years earlier.
One morning before work, my body cramped up. Like, it was just one huge cramp. It's kind of like the same thing with Rodney. They're like, your kidneys are gone.
Both men began dialysis and would soon need a new kidney. Susan and Lance moved up their wedding.
It was devastating for me to watch my husband try to be the strongest as he could, you know, for his new wife and his new family.
And last winter, the coworkers ran into each other in a work bathroom.
She mentioned again that she and her husband were not a match. And I asked her, well, what was his blood type? And she said, O negative.
Tia is O positive, meaning she was likely the match that Lance was looking for.
So in that moment, I was just stopped in my tracks. And I thought, well, what if we could match for each other?
And so Tia and Susan provided a kidney to the other's spouse.
Oh.
They both matched and they both provided a kidney to the others. They barely knew each other, and I said nurses, but they were IT. Black and white in this Atlanta hospital, co-workers, and this is how people actually get along in the real world and help each other out when they can, as opposed to this demagoguery you hear from race hustlers around the country. Great, great story.
Listen to podcast of Dan and Amy from the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. President Trump at CPAC in Dallas yesterday had this to say about his much-discussed lawsuit against big tech companies earlier in the week.
The big tech election interference in 2020 was an outrageous assault upon our republic and upon the American voter. Terrible thing has happened to our country. We're being laughed at all over the world. Our election has been studied by other countries. They're not going to do it that way. Mark Zuckerberg alone spent $400 million on election meddling. In virtually all of the key swing states, he funded unmanned and unprotected drop boxes that were deployed in Democrat-run cities and heavily Democrat precincts to scoop up ballots which were supposedly 94, 95, 96% for Joe Biden because he campaigned so well from his basement. How about where Biden did substantially better in the swing states than Barack Hussein Obama with the black population. Now, even though he did terribly throughout the country, but in those five places, he did very well. You know about that, Louis, right? He did five places. He did very well. Beat Obama with the black population. I don't think so. But they practiced that and countless other schemes to illegitimately and illegally boost the Democrat vote. The drop boxes were often very late. Where are they? Where are they? What happened? They're supposed to be here. They're not. I can tell you what happened. sometimes late by days in showing up to the vote counting areas. At the same time, the big tech giants worked together to suppress and diminish news coverage that was negative for Joe Biden. Look at all these stories that came up, and they were wiped out. Anything negative for Biden or the radical left Democrats, they just suppressed.
And of course, the prime example that he went on to give was the Hunter Biden laptop story.
Well, if that was Don Jr.'s or Eric Trump's laptop, are you kidding me? We would know everything that was in it. But since it was Hunter Biden's, they squashed it.
Well, and to the extent that we do know a lot of what was in it, it gets coverage only in, you know, outlets of a certain perspective. The connection, though, the connection between election influence and the class action suit that he filed against these big tech companies. A good piece by Vivek Ramaswamy in The Wall Street Journal. He is a successful tech entrepreneur. He's also the author of a book called Woke Inc., Inside Corporate America's Social Justice Scam. And he has it right when he describes the central claim of the class action suit filed by Trump against big tech companies. Basically, he says they're state actors, right? Because the First Amendment is a restraint on government, not private sector actors. So you have to make the case, and it's a difficult one to make, that a private actor is acting as a surrogate of the state or a co-agent with the state. And the argument is that the government granted them immunity from legal liability. That's Section 230 of the Comms Act. Threatened to punish them if they allowed disfavored speech, and colluded with them in choosing the targets for censorship. And this is to what sort of what Trump was saying in terms of what was suppressed that was, you know, almost inarguably newsworthy, and what was allowed, and was there collusion, if you will, between the two entities, between the government and these big tech companies. That's something he's going to have to prove. That's going to be very difficult to do. I still think that the case has a slim chance of success, but it is driving an important conversation, as we discussed last week. To continue that conversation, we're pleased to be joined by Amy Pykoff. She is the chief policy officer for Parler, which is a build-your-own-castle competitor to Twitter, of course. Amy, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, Dan. So I'm glad you basically summarized this case. This case, this filing, you know, I'm coming at this from the perspective of a libertarian voter. I've never voted for Trump. I voted for Gary Johnson. I voted for Joe Jorgensen. I'm not really a huge fan of Trump. But what's interesting is I think that this lawsuit, whatever chance it does have, and maybe I'm more optimistic than you are about it, this could be the perfect vehicle to solve this problem of big tech censorship. You know, you laid out the case and Vivek's piece. I took a glance at that this morning. It's excellent. You know, it follows upon the piece that he did with Jed Rubenfeld back in January on this theory. There's one aspect of it, which is that the Section 230 protections are arguably overbroad. The immunity is arguably overbroad. And this gives Congress more of an argument for the lever that they're trying to use against big tech, right? Because there are real problems with the immunity, the grant of the immunity, and what big tech has done. And both Republicans and Democrats have complaints about it. So they are exerting pressure. They are exerting pressure so that that immunity is exercised in the way that certain politicians want it to be. And this is a real problem. And as you said, also, there is, in certain cases, a bit of collusion. And Trump cites some examples in his lawsuit. So I'm cautiously optimistic that this lawsuit could be the way to do it. And here's why. If Congress was to pass an amendment to Section 230 right now with the Democrats in power, it would likely make that immunity contingent upon hate speech censorship,
right,
misinformation censorship, right? And so that would be built into law, whereas a lawsuit could do something very narrowly tailored and not create further entanglement between government and big tech. Because
yeah,
that's the problem. Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah, but the flip side is this the purview of the courts or the Congress? And as you point out, with respect to some grumbling from both sides about the Section 230 protections. The problem is they have very different ideas about how to solve them, and they have more grumblings about each other than that section. And so, you know, do you ever get anything other than speechifying? I'm not so sure on that. And also, right. too, I mean, you know, from the perspective of somebody representing a social media company, Parler, you know, do you have concerns that the elimination of Section 230 protections, if not narrowly tailored, like you're saying, could boomerang on smaller players? We had this conversation with William Jacobson, who runs the Legal Insurrection blog and, of course, is a Cornell mm-hmm. law professor. And, you know, he had some protections. Like, you know, if I'm going to be considered a publisher because there's, for example, comments section to some of my articles, and I have to monitor those sure. Comments, then, you know, I have the sort of legal exposure that I'm not looking for and really can't abide and, right. and still run my blog.
No, I mean, a repeal would cause a lot of problems, at least in the short term, while all the precedent was sorted out, right? But I think the probably the most, you know, kind of promising solution is one that could be achieved by this lawsuit, which is Justice Thomas has argued for a narrower interpretation of Section 230. So keep the existing language, but give it a proper interpretation. And people who want to read about that just need to read his statement when the Supreme Court denied certiorari in Malwarebytes versus Enigma. So that's Malwarebytes, as if it was all one word, versus Enigma. Reason Magazine had a nice write-up on that statement a while ago. And to me, that seems like the best way to go. And like I said, ironically, Trump's lawsuit might be the thing that could achieve just that solution and get away from this big brother entanglement between government and big tech.
Well, so you think this is going to go all the way to the Supreme Court?
I would hope. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, they talked about he filed it in Florida and he should have filed it in California. And why did he do that and whatever? But all I know is that a lawsuit like this seems to me to be the most promising way to solve this problem properly.
Well, as a libertarian, what about, you know, the posture that, hey, go build your own castle. Jack Dorsey built his and Mark Zuckerberg built his and Sergey and Larry and Sundar built theirs at Google. Stop bitching sure. and do what Parler's doing. Go build your own castle and compete with these companies.
Well, so obviously we've been doing that at Parler. And what we've bumped up against now is, I think, arguably an instance of this entanglement. So, you know, Amazon got very, very powerful in part due to the government lockdowns. The government imposed lockdowns made them have a whole lot more cash on their hands. In addition, they ended up working, you know, they have taken on Twitter as one of their big clients as of December of this past year. And it could also be that, you know, some people in Congress were also pressuring, because what was happening in January when we were deplatformed, we were deplatformed on the very week that Trump was banned from Twitter and he was rumored to be coming over to Parler. And then suddenly we get these notices that we're going to be taken down off of our servers.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure people are interested, since you're back up and running and you're on somebody else's servers than Amazon's, which is always a good idea, sort of a cautionary tale. Don't expect your enemies to provide you infrastructure or any sort of aid and support. But how is Parler doing these days? What's the plan to going forward?
So we are doing well. We have rebuilt everything from the ground up. So not only the stack that, you know, provides the access to the internet and you know, the server capacity, but also the code base. And so what we're doing on a daily basis is our development team is hard at work improving and bringing back some of the more, you know, kind of nuanced features that we had before. And we are ready to continue to fight this free speech battle. You know, we need to provide a platform that is viewpoint neutral, that everybody can come and think for themselves. They're not going to be told what they should think about a particular topic, what they should write and say. On Parler, the feed that you get is the feed that you ask for. And with respect to all legal speech, we put the tools into the hands of individual users to decide what's in their feed. We're very optimistic that this is the way to go for the future.
So the concern about Parler going forward, I mean, for me as a user, would be, can you get people that are center left or even further left, if you want, you know, the influencers in these, the institutional influencers, those are far left, so you have to get them too. Can you get them in the same place the way that so many are on Twitter, so that you can have that back and forth? Because if it's just an echo chamber for conservatives, it gets a little boring. Now, at the same time,
definitely,
in order to get that more expansive audience, then you're also going to have to deal with the balance of, you know, cranks and trolls who use language that's unacceptable. And so how do you monitor that? I mean, it's easy to say free marketplace of ideas. It's a little bit harder to manage in a way that's attractive to get the kind of audience you want. And so I wonder, you know, how you're trying to thread that needle.
Yeah. So what we do, you know, again, a lot of this kind of speech that you're talking about, the trolling stuff, is legal. It's perfectly legal. And philosophically and normatively, everything, I think the best way to do this is to put the tools in the hands of the individual user. And that's what we've done. As we've come back online, we've brought online some AI that will allow us not only to get rid of the incitement, the actual violent content that's illegal, but also to create a filter for the trolling content that we put in the hands of the individual user. Now, Apple requires that you remove all such content for any, you know, from any iOS app. That's their choice, and I think they're wrong in that. But what I do think is right is to give users the tools that they can use to exclude that from their feeds and to provide them the experience that they want on Parler.
Now, what's the latest with getting President Trump on Parler?
I know that we are eager to have him. You know, again, I'm sorry I didn't vote for him, but we welcome him. We want to allow his viewpoint to be expressed as well as everybody else. So I think there are some discussions about inviting him over. Whichever platform does get him, of course, will end up getting quite a bit of traffic, so it would be a great thing. But I gather he's weighing his options.
You should try and woo Amy over, too. She's got a lot
right.
of followers.
No, I've...
But she's like, she's been conditioned by all this, like, give me concert tickets, give me a gun, give me whiskey to get the vaccine. So you're going to have to give her something.
He's kidding. Yes. I am signed up to Parler.
Oh, you are?
But I haven't parlored lately.
All
is
right,
that the verbiage you use? Like when you're on Twitter, you tweet. When you're on Parler, you do what, Amy?
You parlay.
Okay, well,
That's a gambling term. Maybe that'll get it. Maybe that's good enough to get her in since she's a lotto junkie.
I like it. And you guys have to give me your username so I can follow you over there.
All right.
Mine is
at Dan Proft. You know, just
okay,
my name.
Wait, hold on. Wait, I got to find my Parler app.
We got to get the chief policy officer follows us. That'll be good standing.
That would be
for
huge. I think I'm Amy Jacobson. I mean, I know my name is Amy Jacobson with an O, not an E, but I don't know what my Parler. Here it is.
Yeah, just make sure, you know, if you're going to go to iOS, download the latest version because they just updated it recently.
I'm Amy E. Jacobson.
What's the E stand for?
Okay. Elizabeth. Elephant. Right. My middle name's Elephant.
All right. All right. Well, this was fun, and including the sort of like the handle exchange. Amy Bykoff, Chief Policy Officer, easy for me to say, for Parler. I'm so excited she's following me. Chief Policy Officer for Parler. Amy, thanks for joining us and continued success with Parler.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. On AM 560, The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, and over the last couple of weeks, the agreed upon talking point in defense of critical race theory is that the assertion that is being taught at the K-12 level, that is a lie. That is not happening. Not happening. And this is nothing more than one philosophical construct that is taught in some law schools as a way to, you know, understand the dynamics of power in the world. Again, I mean, it's not me saying it. I mean, here's the vaunted Randy Weingarten at the AFT confab on critical race theory.
Let's be clear. Critical race theory is not taught in elementary schools or middle schools or high schools. It's a method of examination taught in law school and in college that helps analyze whether systemic racism exists.
Kimberly Crenshaw, Columbia Law School, on the equally vaunted Joy Reid show. Ha ha ha. She is the woman credited with intersectional theory. Here's Professor Crenshaw on critical race theory.
I'm one of the co-authors of one of the few books on critical race theory. I think I would know if we were being taught in K through 12. I mean, basically, critical race theory, classic critical race theory, is a law school course.
Not happening. So you could imagine my surprise when I saw at that same American Federation for Teachers Union confab there an interview of one Henry Rogers, a.k.a. Ibram Kendi, by one of the AFT functionaries, in which he offered this introduction of Kendi's new book, Stamped, done in conjunction with another race hustler named Jason Reynolds, called For Children, Explicitly For Children.
Our goal is to get copies of this book into the hands of middle and high school students across the country to inspire them to have courageous conversations about racism. Also, how they can become anti-racist themselves and help create anti-racist schools and communities.
Oh, now we're going to... Now I know what you're going to do. You're going to do a Joy Reid on me. You're going to say, he's not a critical race theorist. He's an anti-racist theorist. And so that doesn't count. Okay. No, it's not happening, though. No, it's not happening, and certainly not happening at their hands. Speaking of which, here's what Ibram Kendi had to say about critical race theory, or his version of it, how to be an anti-racist. And he just can't figure out what conservatives, a.k.a. racists, are so concerned about.
There are some folks in the right wing who have made you into a controversial figure, or tried to make you into a controversial figure. Can you tell us what you see your role as in this anti-racist movement, what being anti-racist means to you, and why you continue to be a prominent voice in this movement despite the vitriol you have had to face?
Well, I think for me, it's that we live, unfortunately, in a society of racial disparities and inequities, and certainly those disparities and inequities are harmful for adults, but they're even doubly devastating for children. And I know, based on all sorts of studies, that those disparities are not the result of what's wrong with children or what's wrong with adults. That are let's say people of color, they're the result of policies and practices. And so for me, to be anti-racist is to really encourage us to see those practices and policies as the problem, rather than people, as we're taught to believe. And apparently that's a controversial idea.
Oh, the sophistry. For more on this, let's break it down with Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributing American Spectator. And also, he's down there in Bayou Country, remarking just before the break on the passing of Edwin Edwards. And I was correct. He did go away for racketeering, 10 years in federal prison.
Okay.
So I was on solid ground calling him a convicted felon. Scott McKay, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Yes, he was a convicted felon.
Yeah.
And he was also somebody who got away with all kinds of things before the dice finally came up snake eyes for him.
I was remarking.
I'd like to stick that in the mix too.
Yeah, I was remarking on it because one of my favorite campaign slogans of all time, when he ran against David Duke for governor, and his campaign slogan was vote for the crook. It's important.
Right.
Yeah,
right.
That's a classic. I mean,
you know, that was the worst state level election in American history. And it is, game, set, and match to the argument about whether a jungle primary is a good thing. It's not. So just so everybody knows, so don't do a jungle primary if you don't want to end up with Edwin Edwards versus David Duke, because sooner or later that's what you're going to get.
Good. That's a good point. That is a good argument, a good case study. So as to Ibram Kendi, you know, he's doing it for the kids, Scott, and this is controversial. He's completely baffled by the controversy.
Well, and at Front Page Mag late last week, Daniel Greenfield did one of the most authoritative, brutal takedowns of anyone that I've ever seen on Henry Rogers, a.k.a. Ibram X. Kendi. I mean, he went through the guy's background and basically just took his book, the anti-racism book, apart almost line by line. For what a complete fraud this guy is. I mean, you know, he grew up in exactly the environment that everybody wants to see, you know, be normal in Black America, which, you know, to a larger extent than we're led to believe is normal in Black America. I mean, he had, you know, two loving parents who were professionals who, you know, succeeded as Americans. One of them is a business planner, the other is an accountant. You know, they paid for him to go to college, and, you know, rather than come up with something useful to do, you know, he majored and marinated in all of this, you know, critical theory stuff, and then ultimately, you know, found a grift as a critical race theorist. I mean, this entire thing is nothing but, you know, a way to avoid having to do real work for a living. And you know, make some money off a scam. And we've enabled this, and now it's completely run amok. And, you know, this guy is, I mean, you know, I don't want to call him a no-talent bum because he has a talent, but his talent is as a grifter.
Right.
And you know, you really ought to read Greenfield's takedown of him because he makes it very clear. But, I mean, you know, critical race theory is a grift. Everything about it it's a complete scam, and it's a very dangerous, destructive scam at that. You know, there's no, I mean, you know, the people who are these scam artists that are pushing it, of course they're not going to tell the truth about whether they're going to, you know, whether they're doing it in the K-12 format as well as college education. I mean, it's everywhere. They're doing it in corporate training. They're now doing it in the military. They've certainly done it in pro sports and the culture and the newsrooms. You know, and they're going to make us out to be conspiracy theorists when we point out, hey, this is what you're doing.
Well, is anybody, I mean, he doesn't believe what he's scamming people, right? I mean, is there anything to that?
Well, you know,
is he such a good actor?
There's a famous line from Ghostbusters.
Sure.
And it's, you know, they're interviewing Ernie Hudson for the job as the, I guess, fourth Ghostbuster, right? And it's, you know, and it's like, hey, do you believe in astral projection and all this? He stops and says, look, if there's a steady paycheck in it, I'll believe anything you say.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's a certain aspect of that to critical race theory where people have recognized what a great grift it is. And, you know, it's like, hey, I'm convinced I can make money off of this. So, you know, I'm good. And if you do that long enough, you know, you start to become a passionate advocate of something that you initially, you know, knew was a scam that you could just get in on.
Yeah, it's basically being a race gangster, right? I mean, it's, you know, first you get the money, then you get the power, then you get the women sort of thing.
There's no question.
Right. So the question is what to do about it for conservatives. And this is becoming a bit of a debate. An interesting piece by Chris Rufo, who's been at the front of the skirmish line on this over at Manhattan Institute City Journal. And this is in response to criticisms of governors who have moved to ban critical race theory from being part of the curriculum in K-12 public schools in their states, or in the case of Arizona, you know, ban its usage in state government, for example. And the argument advanced by David French and Thomas Chatterton Williams is basically the typical free marketplace of ideas argument. We don't want to eliminate it. We don't want to be in the business of banning. We want to be in the business of confronting and conquering through the better argument, building the better intellectual mousetrap, as it were. And Rufo argues that by defending phantom freedoms, intellectuals are ushering in concrete tyrannies. In other words, you don't have a marketplace of ideas in these K through 12 school systems. So when you say don't ban it, but have a marketplace of ideas, you're not going to get a marketplace of ideas. You're just going to get critical race theory. There's going to be no tolerance for dissent. And so you're going to be facilitating the imposition of these mini authoritarian regimes in K through 12 school systems.
Well, what does a marketplace of ideas look like when you're educating third graders? They're 8 years old. They're going to believe what you tell them, right? I mean, the idea that this is some sort of, some sort of all you can eat buffet of educational options that you're going to put in front of, you know, grammar school kids is, it's so obviously ridiculous that now you have to start asking who's paying these people to say it, because, that is absolutely without merit whatsoever. You know, and then the other thing is, David French is a lawyer who people hire to, you know, sue school systems and other governmental agencies after the horses have left the barn and they're now being persecuted. So the question is, you know, whether David French is perfectly good with this, you know, new nanny state totalitarian society that the left is so anxious to build, because, you know, he gets to be the controlled opposition, who bills $200 an hour, to try to sweep some crumbs off the floor and feed people. And, you know, I think we can do better than that. I don't think that the conservative movement or the majority of America who has no use for critical race theory is under any obligation to provide David French with a livelihood. I think he can, you know, go learn the code if he doesn't like this. But the fact that public school curricula, that's put together on the basis of what school boards agree on at public meetings with public input, you know, largely, hopefully, from parents. And it's made, you know, in a legislative setting at the state legislature and at school boards and at, you know, state boards of education. That's how you decide what curriculum is. And the idea that conservatives can't step in and say no to critical race theory is, it's unrecognizable as a prospect. I mean, I think that's a ridiculous thing to say. And so much so that I think it discredits the people who say it.
I was sticking on ridiculous things to say. I think I identified the death knell for capitalism in America. Joe Biden tweeting out, "Let me be clear, capitalism without competition isn't capitalism, it's exploitation." He issued an executive order promoting, quote unquote, capitalism as well, promoting competition and therefore capitalism. So, Joe Biden, your Democrat, socialist, capitalist, capitalism, so long as it's properly centrally planned.
What I took from that was, does that mean we're going to get the antitrust case against Google now? I mean, because I'm okay with that. You know, I mean, I'll make common cause with Joe Biden on an antitrust case against Google, or, you know, if you like, Apple, Amazon, Facebook, and Twitter. I'm good with all of that. I mean, anybody who has to use Microsoft products, I write novels and I work in Microsoft Word because there's not much else I could. Trust me, I'm perfectly good with finishing the job on Microsoft's antitrust issues. I'm all for competition and capitalism. Let's actually see it in the tech space. And, of course, you know, I don't have any faith that Joe Biden is serious about that.
He is Scott McKay, publisher at The Hayride, contributor to The American Spectator as well. Scott, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, thanks, guys. Have a great week.
Take care.
Thanks.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer. Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.